The Brewing Network is proud to present Beer Radio, that turns ordinary homebrew, into award-winning beer. The Jameel Show. And now, your hosts, Jameel Zainasheff and John Plisse.
Good morning, Doc.
Good morning, John. How you doing?
You don't look like Jameel.
Don't feel like Jameel.
You're much better looking.
Oh, good. Thanks. Don't let him hear that. Hopefully he's still over on the European continent.
Yeah.
Well, this morning it's Oktoberfest in Martin.
Yeah, it's time to brew.
All right. So hopefully we'll shed some light on this for you. This is one of the first styles, or probably the first style that I used to break into the lager realm. It's a pretty decent beer. It's a lot of building in this beer. It's not a very simple beer.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had a lot of different forms of this one through the years, and I think I've come up with a pretty good recipe that I like, and most people like this one too. In fact, last year I brewed this one with Bob Schwarz, and it made it into the second round of the NHC.
Nice job.
So it worked out pretty. I was pretty proud of that. And he was too. So
it's a little competitive.
In fact, when I first brewed this one, for at least the final recipe with this one, JJ at EJ Fair liked it so much that he wanted to use it in his lineup.
He probably is right now, but we don't know it.
Yeah. Well, I've talked to Morgan about it, and he wanted to dry it out some.
Okay.
So he's changed it here and there and upped and down few things, and you know, that's what home brewing's all about. Mm-hmm. And brewing is, you know, make it yours. So, well, let's get into this, a little bit of the history on it. Oktoberfest and Martin, and I'm gonna treat those pretty much as the same thing.
Yeah, it's the same.
If anybody asks you what's the difference on there, you can just say pretty much it's the same thing. Basically, it has to do with October and March. Back when they used to not brew so much during the summertime.
Well, they didn't have refrigerators. So.
They couldn't do it. I'm sure they could have done it in the ice caves and things, but mm-hmm. I think there's so much more flora and things in the air going around in the summertime that they would get a lot of sour beers, a lot of things. So they brew all winter long, and some of the last beers that they brewed, which ended in March, needed to last cold in the caves all the way till they started brewing again in October. So they would actually up the gravity, and so they could lay them down a lot longer.
Right.
And so during the summer, they'd be drinking what they had, or what they brewed in the months prior to that one, and then the last beer, they bring it out with a bang.
Yeah.
And even though Munich tries to lay claim, I think, to making this style up, if you really look back far enough, it's more linked. It started in Vienna, and a lot of these, you know, that's why they kind of group these together, the Vienna Martin and mm-hmm. Oktoberfest, because they're all are pretty similar. Just the amber lagers, European amber lagers, and it's changed a lot. It started, you know, in the early 1800s when they started isolating the lager yeasts. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of come here and come there as far as gravities and finishing gravities, alcohol thing. It's been up and down.
Right.
So it's kind of forked off, and the Oktoberfest is more of a southern German thing now than the Vienna. Vienna's a little bit lighter, a little bit mellower. Modern examples are, you know, lower gravity, but the higher attenuation than their historical counterparts. So they brewed them higher before, but it didn't attenuate quite so well. So it's changed even since the 70s.
Well, it's still open to style, though. You can have a lower or high
right.
gravity, though.
Well, I'm just talking about, you know, the okay. historical aspect
right.
of it.
Right.
Originally, it's credited with Gabriel Sattelmeyer. He adapted it from the Vienna style mm-hmm. in the 1840s. And, again, it's typically brewed in the spring, signaling into the typical brewing sessions and make it through the warm summer months. And it just happened to be that, you know, the Oktoberfest festival that they've started, that's become one of the beers.
Well, they brewed for a mm-hmm. giant party.
Yeah, and that's a big thing when they tap the first barrel.
Right.
So that's come up. Let's go over some vital statistics for it. Original gravity, 1050 to 1056. Finishing gravity, about 1012 to 1016, which is trying to get pretty low with one of these beers. We'll go over some things to help get it down there. With a big malt-based beer like this, you can stall at 10.25 if you're not careful, being a lager and big malt-based beer. IBUs, 20 to 28, SRM, about 7 to 14. So you got a pretty good latitude in there. Alcohol, 4.8 to 5.7. Those are general statistics. So let's go over some of the other things. Flavor, aromas. It's basically, the aroma is going to be rich, malty, that kind of stuff. Light to moderate. You can get some toasted malts in there. Some of the better ones I've tasted, the people have actually toasted their own malt.
Really?
Yeah.
Their own base malts?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of people try to experiment doing that one.
Interesting.
You got a clean lager aroma. You don't want any fruity esters, no diacetyl. No hop aroma. This isn't a hop-based beer.
It's all malt-based. Yeah.
And if too much caramel, you got to be careful of that. Most the recipes are going to have some caramel in it, but you got to be careful so it doesn't dominate. That's not what you really want to have here. It's going to be dark golden, deep orange-red color. You want it clear, though, for a darker beer, but you still really want it clear. And flavor, it's going to be, initially, it's going to be malty sweet, but it can be finished dry or moderately dry. That's another thing with helping your yeast out to get it to be that dry. Noble hops are usually what you want to use, flavor it. Low to none, balance towards malt, that kind of thing. Mouthfeel, it's going to be a medium body beer. It's not going to be really chewy, but a creamy, malty texture to it. Smooth.
Well, it's usually malty up front and
right.
It finishes relatively dry.
It won't be a thin beer, but you don't want to be chewy like a wee heavy.
No.
Something like that. And it's a lager. That's what you're going to have come through with that one. It's going to be basically soft, complex, but not overly sweet and nasty.
Right. So don't overdo with your crystal malts.
Right. That goes back to a lot of these things are going to interplay with this and how you're going to get it drier with the yeast. Don't overdo it with crystal malts. And we'll go over here a couple of things on how to get in and build these things. Commercial examples, you're going to Paulaner Oktoberfest, which is what we tried last night. Hackersore, Eyinger, Hofbräu, Spaten. They all pretty much make one. You got some Gordon Biersch, Sam Adams, although Sam Adams is a little bit weird, but it's got some late hopping in there.
Yeah, I've had Sam Adams.
But one thing, if you taste all these from Germany, they're going to be a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
Some are going to be drier. Some are going to be sweeter. Some are going to have more maltiness or more mouthfeel. There's a wide range in this, so there's no exact copy of what it should be. But it's kind of a general idea.
Amber lager.
Amber lager, right.
Yeah.
And when it comes down to it, you probably won't brew what you're looking for the first time, but there's a lot of things to play with in here, and it leaves for experimentation.
Well, it's hard to do well and balanced.
Yeah. So it has to do with what kind of beer you want.
Mm-hmm.
I tweaked it to the point where what I want, not necessarily what somebody else's idea is of it.
Would you say this beer is a session beer?
No.
No.
Not generally, no.
Okay.
It's
pretty easy drinking.
It is. It is easy to drink, but it's going to be a little higher in alcohol.
Right.
And it is going to be a little more filling because of all the malt.
Right. Well, all the residual, yeah.
I mean, it's not like you can't have a few of them, but knocking back 10 of them might get you in a little trouble.
Yeah. Well, I've had yours, Doc, and it's very good.
Well, thanks.
Yeah,
I've had yours.
Yeah, thanks.
So let's go on. Let's look at some of the ingredients, what we're going to be doing. The Martins are going to be a malt-forward beer. Just keep that in mind when you're making one of these or trying to design this one. Hopping's going to be pretty simple. Pretty much two hop additions, one for bittering, and then one probably in the last 10 to 20 minutes of the boil, just for a little hop flavor and a little aroma.
Right.
You're shooting for a moderate bitterness and a low hop flavor and aroma. I like to build a lot of malt complexity in this type of beer, so it's almost a kitchen sink beer. I like to throw a lot of stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
Start with some main things, and then move it up from there. The base malts are going to be, I group them into two things. One group is going to be Two Row and Pilsner, and the other group is going to be the Munich and Vienna. those are all considered base malts.
Right.
So the first group, I used to like try to keep it about 50%, two row and Pilsner as that group. You can make each one of those within that group whatever you want, 10% two row, 40% Pilsner malt, mm-hmm. and then go with the next group, which is the Munich and Vienna, and you can vary those up and down within that group to make up about 40% of the rest of the malt bill. And then you want to throw in some kind of crystal, maybe possibly some carapils, and get that going, and about another 10%. You can tweak those up around a little bit. Dan Gordon, when he was in here, his basic recipe is going to be about 50% Pils, 40% Munich, and 10% Kara Munich.
Mm-hmm. Well, traditionally, Pilsner malt was what they used
right.
in the style of beer. But you'd be amazed how much changing your base malts really does change the malt profile.
Sure, sure. Right. And so this is the first place you'd probably want to be playing around with everything, is try to stay in those two groups, group the two row and the Pilsner together, and group the Munich and Vienna together, mm-hmm. and play with each one of those, keeping each group at the 50% for the two row Pilsner and the 40% for the Munich. And by changing those up and down, you can really tweak the recipe.
Sure.
You could even, I've even heard of Marzen's being almost all Munich beer, all Munich malt.
Yeah, why not, you know?
And it can convert itself. It has enough that it wouldn't be good if you used a lot of adjuncts or other things,
right.
Because it doesn't have quite enough enzymes to really convert everything, although it'll convert itself.
Right.
But too much Munich, in my experience, is you're going to get, it's almost a cloying sweetness, mm-hmm. too much. And then you got to start playing with other things to kind of balance that
out. Would it finish relatively high in the final gravity?
No, not necessarily. No. Okay. That has to do with your mashing, things like that. But it has to do with, we're trying to build a malt complexity here. Mm-hmm. That's why we're going to use a lot of malts in this.
What about the Vienna? That tends to be higher in color. Would you want it maybe?
It's lighter in flavor, though.
Okay.
So I usually try to use that to cut back on the Munich, because the Munich's going to be a lot stronger of a flavor. So okay. Rather than using, you know, for that 40% of Munich Vienna, using all Munich, I like to use some Vienna to kind of lighten that.
Right.
That flavor profile up some.
I did have a question for you about the color from here.
Okay.
Whether or not you like a lighter or a darker color on your Marzens. One of this person's favorite is the Eyinger Oktoberfest Marzen, which is one of the darker ones. And just curious what you like to do.
I like it darker. I like it close to 10 in the 7 to 14 range, or maybe even up to a 12. I like it to be clear enough, or light enough, so you can see through it until it is so clear. But I'd like it to be dark to have that kind of visual impact to it.
And which malt are you playing with to do that? Is that the Vienna, you said?
Vienna and Munich and your Kara Munich and Kara Vienne.
All of them will give you the dark color.
And actually, you can get darker. You can use some chocolate malt. I like chocolate malt in certain beers.
Or Carafa.
But if you're going to use chocolate malt, stay low, like 1 ounce in your mash. To do that, what I like to do is take the chocolate malt, grind it into a powder, and after the mash is almost done, I sprinkle that on the top and then recirculate through that.
Huh. And how much can that actually change your color? How many SRM are we talking about?
Quite a bit.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Just an ounce.
Yeah. Wow. As long as you grind it up, because I'm only putting it in there for color, and I put it in the mash late, and I sprinkle it on the top.
Mm-hmm.
And then I recirculate over the top of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's such a small amount anyway. Why wouldn't you just put it in for the whole thing? It's not as if you're changing the fermentables or anything then, right? For the whole mash,
I don't like putting that much powdered stuff into my mash.
Okay.
I worry about it filtering.
Okay.
You'll get more flavor, too, from it. When it mashes longer, you'll get more flavor impact.
I don't really want the chocolate flavor coming through. This is mostly just for color.
Okay.
Right. Especially when it's that low, for an ounce in 5 gallons, something like that. So
gotcha.
That's one good way I've learned to change colors on beers, is to use something powdered, like dark.
Mm-hmm.
Carafa would be good, too. But I'm not really putting it in there for the flavor.
No, just color.
And you can put a little more, a little less, just to change the coloring of it. So again, this is an experimental beer for anybody that's not brewed one before.
Right.
Use the guidelines here. Know what your ingredients are going to be and how each one's going to affect that one.
Mm-hmm.
kind of know what Two Roads about, what pills or malts about. You've all used those. Munich and Vienna, a lot of people haven't used those before.
I really like to use Maris Otter base malt
with
a blend of malt. I think you get a darker color in it, but you get more body and more mouthfeel and a slight biscuit edge to it, too, which complements, I think, the Cara Munichs and the Caravines.
Well, some of the malts that I'll use are aromatic. I'll use some of the crystal malts. Use some Cara pills to help with the mouthfeel some.
What do you think aromatic does to your beer?
It gives it a little bit of biscuit.
It does?
Yeah. Okay. Like you don't want very much in there, just enough to you want to use a little bit subtle biscuity. You don't want to have that one be right up front. That's not what this beer is about. But again, it adds to the complexity of the base malt.
Does it contribute at all to the malt aroma that you smell?
You're going to get some of that too.
Okay.
So
I was wondering if that's why they called it aromatic.
Couldn't tell you exactly why they call it aromatic. It's most people use it for the flavor more than anything else. Okay. So that'll pretty much get you in the ballpark for most of the base malts and some of these things. Some of the other crystal malts and things you can use are, Crystal and 60. Carapils, Caravian. There's a new one, Carafoam, but that's not going to give you a whole lot of... That's more like a Carapils.
Right, it's heavy tension.
So that might help some. Aromatics, biscuit malt. You can expand that and get into that, but I would keep that totally in the less than 10%, 10 to 15 at the most.
But you definitely should, I think, use a Cara Munich or a Caravine to get that to help.
Well, for sure put that in there, and then you can add in a little bit of the other ones. Don't use too much of the crystal malts, the English or the American crystal malts. You don't really want to have a caramel flavor coming through. But you could add to it slightly.
Well, they definitely contribute to an intense malt flavor
outside
of the base malts.
But you don't want it to dominate.
Right.
That it will be a fault. You probably won't like it. Kind of use these constraints to make your malt bill and brew it and see what you think. And then there's a lot of room to play, little this, little more of that, little that kind of thing. It'll really come through probably on your second or third batch. You might love the first one.
Yeah.
What I've found is other people really like this beer. Wives, girlfriends, next door neighbors, everybody likes this one. It's a good beer to bring out at a party. You're a homebrew? I've had homebrew before, and then you throw this at them, and it's amazing how many people just can't believe it's a homebrew. It is complex. It's clean.
It's hard to do well clean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's some things we'll get to with those. If you're going to do an extract, I would suggest using a couple of different kinds of extract. Don't stick with a single kind.
Yeah, definitely blend them.
Blend some. You don't necessarily need to go all dark ones. I would probably do mostly a Pilsner or a light-based extract. Used some English.
Yeah, English extract, definitely.
If you can find maybe a little bit of dark. That's going to build a malt character in there and really layer it, too. If you're going to do a mini mash, do kind of what we were talking about with the base grains. If you're going to do an all grain, stick with the 40-50% on each of those, and try to use. I would probably use one kind of extract at that point. If you're going to do a mini mash, let's not make it overly complicated.
Yeah,
try to get probably 40% from your mini mash.
So it's all German pills in your mini mash.
Yeah, German pills, Munich and Vienna probably is what I'd do.
Yeah.
Try to get probably 40% of your gravity points out of it.
And then for your extract, what would you use? Is it English?
I would probably use,
I would use an English.
I would actually probably just go...
Switch it?
English, or I even go something light.
Okay.
If I'm using extract, I like to stick with light and... If I'm doing a mini mash, that much trouble, I'll use the mini mash to put the color in.
Is that a general rule for you? If you're doing an extract, you almost always want to pick a light extract?
That's
that
for me,
Why is that?
Because I usually don't do all extract beers. But I can get color and I can get flavor out of either steeping grains or I'm going to get it more out of my mini mash.
Yeah.
I don't really know how a lot of these guys make their different kinds of extracts.
Yeah.
So maybe they've got things in there that I don't want.
So you just feel it safer if you use a lighter one?
Yeah.
Okay.
I can I if there's a flavor in the darker ones I don't want, it's kind of hard to mask it that way rather than build it up.
Okay. Before you move on from green and color, too, just back to that for a second. Somebody had a question if you know about Cinnamar.
Yeah.
And what you think about that as a darkening agent.
Actually, I haven't had the chance to use it yet. It's a coloring agent. Mm. It's malt-based.
An extract of sort?
Yeah. It's kind of an ultra-concentrated wort.
Okay.
And I think, what is the SRM on that? It's high.
Is it? Okay.
And you need, I think it's 4 ounces probably, I think they said, in 5 gallons, something like that. Hmm. I would keep that one for a Schwartz beer. That's what I want to try it in. I've got to get a hold of some, and I want to try it in a Schwartz beer, because a Schwartz beer needs to be dark without being overly roasty, and that's tough to do. That's what the challenge is on a Schwartz beer. You don't really want it to be roasty, but you know, when you're throwing chocolate or Black Patent or Carafe even in there, it's going to come through to get it that dark and not have the roastiness.
Hmm. Am I the only guy who thinks of Mel Brooks and Spaceballs every time somebody says Schwartz beer? May the Schwartz be with you. You guys don't know what I'm talking about?
I know what you're talking about. Yeah. That's awesome.
Sorry.
I'd like to get a hold of some. I just kind of was on the hunt to get some for a while.
Now, somebody here had just gotten some and just wanted me to ask if you were familiar with it and had used that as a... be interesting. I think that's, you know, new product like that to try out.
For a long time, us as homebrewers couldn't get it. Because they sold it in big tubs, and we don't need big tubs of it. But now more and more the homebrew shops are starting to break it up into smaller bits for us and get that one. Does Beer More Beer have that?
I don't think so.
Northern Brewer, I think you might be able to get it. But that's probably, next time I make a Schwartz beer, that's what I'll be using, is that Cinnamar. All right, so we've kind of gone through the base malts and getting those things through. That's going to be your main goal when you're starting to make this recipe. Then the extract and get that one. And when we come back, we'll start talking about hops and the bittering ratios and things.
Yes, sir. Once I live the life of a millionaire. Wow! I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't.
Now, back to the Jameel
Show. How you doing, John?
I woke up with a cold this morning. Man. I'm all right. Going to go home and have a beer.
That's good.
Yeah, thanks, man. I feel good.
All right, so let's start talking about the hops in this thing. Let's start out with the BU to GU ratio. That's the bittering units to gravity units ratio. A lot of people have heard about that, but they don't really know what that is. It's your bittering units in IBUs divided by the gravity units. Gravity units, basically take your 1050, use just the last two digits, which is 50.
Right.
So if your IBUs are 25 and your gravity units are 50, you're going to have a 0.5 BU to GU ratio. And that's a pretty good exam. You can really tell how hoppy or how malt based it is. It's going to be closer to one if it's going to be more hoppy beer, and less so. So this one's going to have about a 0.57, or that comes out to be about 25 to 35. One good thing that the BU GU ratio is going to do for you is if you want to change your final gravity, either up or down, that stays the same, so you can adjust up or down your IBUs. So it's pretty automatic to do that one.
I don't even know how to calculate my IBUs.
That's what ProMash is for.
No. I just look at the kettle and be like, huh, that looks good.
Well, just think of this. It's you're going to have your starting gravity at 1050.
Okay.
But now this one, you want it bigger. And you want to have your starting gravity at 1057.
Okay.
So use your 0.57 against your gravity units, and that'll tell you what your IBUs range should be. And then you got to figure out what kind of hops or how much hops you're going to need to put in there to make those IBUs.
Okay.
But at least they'll give you your target IBUs.
Okay.
All right, so let's go on to hops, which kind to use. Generally for this one, again, it's a German beer. Noble hops is what you want to use. Hallertau is probably your main one. Tet, Saz, those things.
Yeah, I think saws. Mm-hmm.
You can use the U.S. descendants for this thing, too, the ones that, you know, they bred from the Hallertau or from the other ones. Liberty comes up a lot. I've used that one. It's basically a Hallertau derivative.
Mm-hmm.
Sterling's another one, but that's a Saz and a Mount Hood. Mount Hood would be good. Glacier, maybe. You could probably use that one in there. Santium would probably be a pretty good one.
Really?
Well, it's a Tet and Hallertau cross.
Huh.
So, again, you're not going to want to really be thrusting forward with a lot of hops in this beer.
Yeah.
So, you're going to want to have it in the background to balance. You got a lot of malt here, so you need to balance it, but you don't want to go above the point where you're going to have too many.
You don't want a bitter.
No. You don't want a bitter, and you don't really want a lot of hop aroma and stuff. One thing you said, you don't want it bitter, so you want to stay away from the high alpha hops. If you problem with high alpha hops, you can go over real easily. One pellet sometimes is enough when you got 15, 16 alpha acid hop.
Right.
Where when you're using a 4, something around the 4 range, like a Hallertau, you can a little more, a little less isn't going to make as big difference than if you're using a Magnum, a little more, a little less.
Right.
And if you're not real diligent about measuring that out, then you could easily go over. Plus, it's going to be a little harsher on that one, so it's not so much you want to do. Basically, with this one, you're going to have two hop additions, one at the beginning of the boil, and for 5 gallons with these hops, probably in the half ounce range.
Yeah, and then maybe an ounce for the finish?
An ounce, 3/4 to an ounce in the finish in the last probably 10 to 20 minutes of the boil.
Right.
I know that would kill Justin to only put that much hops in.
He would throw Magnum in.
Oh, yeah.
No, he'd be looking at those 2 ounces of hops that he has and just his hand would be shaking.
I don't know what that sissy shit is you guys are talking about. I'm going to throw some hops in there.
It's a balanced, delicate matter.
Hey, I did have a question about IBUs.
Okay.
All right. An IBU is an IBU no matter what hop it comes from, right? So, for example, you know what I'm getting at. I know that you would use less hops if it has a higher alpha acid to get an IBU. But what I'm saying is, one IBU that comes from an ounce of this and one IBU that comes from 2 ounces of that, it's still the same, isn't it?
Yeah, the IBU is going to be your measurement of bitterness.
Okay. So it really doesn't matter where it comes from.
No, it's just that's what I was talking about with John.
Yeah.
You figure out where your target IBUs are and then figure out, usually with ProMash, how you're going to get there.
Right.
Hops change from year to year with their alpha acid content.
Yeah.
It depends on how long you put it in for and your conversion units. One thing you remember is IBUs have about a 5-fold threshold. So you got to go up 5 IBUs before you'll taste a difference for most people.
Some people change.
Yeah. So if you're going to change, you're going to say, I want to up my IBUs, do it about 5 units.
Right.
Then it'll be noticeable.
Okay.
If you go from 20 to 22, you're really not going to notice it so much.
Right.
But
okay.
If you go 20 to 25, 25 to 30, that's for most people.
Okay. Put those two beers side by side, most people are going to know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then just as a side note, because you mentioned using ProMash to do that, even the trial version is a free version, which I have. That's definitely one part that I did figure out how to use in the program. Not that it's a complicated program, but there's a lot of things to it. It's cool to mess around with those IBUs because it allows you to put in what hop you're using, what the alpha acid of that hop is, and then adjust the boil time for how long it's going to be in there. And it's kind of fun just to play with the boil times of the same amount of hops or play with the amount of hops and not change the boil time and see how your IBUs go up and down.
That's how I do it.
I put it up to 5 pounds of hops for the 1 minute. My IBUs didn't change. It didn't really do anything at all. But if I changed it by just 1/4 of an ounce for the 1 hour hop addition, the bittering addition, it changed the IBUs a ton.
Yeah. I've noticed when I was figuring out the late hopping addition for the Classic American Pilsner, the difference between 10 minutes and 20 minutes is pretty dramatic.
Okay.
So you almost have to if you put it in at 20 minutes, you have to put about half of what you put in at 10 minutes.
Okay, gotcha.
It's a big jump at that point.
It's just cool to do. You guys should download the free version of ProMash if you don't have it. If not, just to kind of mess with that.
You'll notice a lot of things, what they play off of.
Opens your eyes about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah. Okay, so that's pretty much the hop thing. It's not a lot of hops there, and you've got some ideas to get through that one. You don't have to use European hops. There's a few out there. If you go on brewmonkey.com, they've got click on Brew School, and they basically go over a lot of the hops and where they come from, what the different levels of cohumulone and myrcene and those kind of complements, and what you can use them for. They've even got a little section for substitution, what you can use. Suppose you can't get Santium, what would be a good substitution? And it's a pretty cool page. Got a lot of information there. If you really want to know about a certain hop, something I mentioned, you never heard of it, it even tells you if, you know, how much is being grown. And as we were talking last night, it has to do with, you know, how long it's going to be around by how much demand it's going to have. Some I see hops come and I see them go. Sometimes I don't even get to use them before I can't get them anymore.
Like Amarillo.
Yeah. That's going to be around a while. That's a pretty popular one.
Now, yeah.
Okay, so let's go over to yeast. The four basic ones that I've kind of written down here are the Oktoberfest, Marzen Lager, German Bock Lager, and the Southern German Lager. They're all lager yeast. You got to play with them quite a bit and coddle them. They do have a bit of differences in all of them. The one I've kind of settled on, or the two I've kind of settled on, are the German Bock Lager and the Southern German. I kind of like those. It's a kind of a softer, rounder.
They're cleaner, too.
They're cleaner. The Oktoberfest Marzen, as I was discussing with John, I didn't like the way that one came out. It's harsh.
Well, it's got a lot of sulfur in like the first 3 months.
Yeah.
It takes a long time for that to go away.
The sulfur will go away. It's just that's typical of a lager yeast.
Mm-hmm.
Some throw more, some throw less, and it will age out. But if you're into drinking your beer really quick, you're probably not going to like that one.
Well, the Bock yeast is really good for a quick turnaround.
Mm-hmm.
It's very clean.
Yeah, I know Jamil really likes that Bock yeast. It's probably one of the wider used ones around for that. I usually split the batches and try the different yeasts, and I've pretty much been through a lot of these. I've tried Bohemian Pilsner with it.
Really?
How
was that?
A little cleaner, but it took away a lot of the maltiness. At least that I could notice that. I didn't really like it. It wasn't bad, but I just didn't like the flavor profile. It's kind of, you know, you have two beers, and you're going to prefer one over the other, and that wasn't one of them.
Did it dry your beer out? Or
It was perception, I think, more than anything else, because the gravities were still there.
Right.
So it just has, you know, the subtleties of a lager yeast, which is what a lot of this is.
You guys know what the numbers are on those yeast?
Yeah. The White Labs, those are the numbers that I use. So the Oktoberfest is the 820. The German Lager is the 830. The German Bock yeast is the 833. If you're going to try one, I would first start with that one. Mm-hmm. And the Southern German Lager is the 838. Most of them have, you know, similar characteristics as far as flocculation. Most of them are medium flocculation, although the Southern German Lager will clear faster because it's got a higher flocculation.
Right.
Fermentation ranges are, you know, in low. If you can't, you know, get it low enough, the Oktoberfest Marzen is probably better if you're going to be around the 55 range, something like that. I try to ferment these lower, you know, below 50.
Like 48?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, about that. The attenuations are kind of different for each one of them.
Mm-hmm.
You can look it up on their website. Probably the German Lager, the 830 is less attenuative, so it's not going to dry it out. If you want to have it more attenuative.
That yeast also has a lot of fruit character to it. You know, it's kind of overwhelming in my opinion, but...
Japan, just look at them side by side, kind of, you know, where your fermentation temperatures, where you think you can keep it, what you want to have for flocculation. The flocculation doesn't really matter as much because this one's going to lay down for a while, hopefully.
Yeah.
Okay. Hopefully you'll be able to lay it down for a while, and it'll clear, just not as fast. Attenuation's probably going to be more of a main thing for you, how dry you want the beer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you treat them right, you'll get it down to what you want to have.
One thing to note, too, is a German Bock I've used at higher temps, like 58, low 60s, and it still came out very clean and not that fruity, so it's pretty resilient to high temps.
Okay. Yeah, it's... The lager, the yeast are very finicky. They don't like the, you know, temperature fluctuations. They freak out real easy. Everything's going to be slower at the cooler temps. They will ferment at a higher temp, but they throw a lot of things in there you don't want.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
Yeah, they would love to be fermenting at 65 in the corner of the kitchen, but you know, it's not, you're not going to get what you want. But they'll just, everything's going to be a little bit slower, and it will come out, but you got to baby these things.
Yeah. What about if you can't lager at those temperatures? What's that, San Francisco lager yeast? Would you recommend that?
Like
the high 50s, low 60s, if you're trying, you know?
Well, what a lot of people think, they can take the San Francisco lager yeast and ferment it at 65.
Right.
I've tried that just to see what happens, and it's not a good thing. Okay. It's okay, but not in this beer.
Right.
Side by side, it's not the one, not the keg I prefer to have. I usually go through the other one first.
Right.
If you can get the San Francisco lager yeast, you know, at 58, 55, something like that, you'll get a lot better out of it. But you really need to ferment low.
Ferment cold, yeah.
Really cold this one. Okay, so let's go on to the next thing. Water. I could get ugly on this one, but let's just go real simple with this. Your water, moderate carbonate water. You got a lot of dark grains in there, so you really don't want to have it over carbonate water, but about up to about 300 parts per million, 150 be even better. You want your sulfates to be low, so don't be adding gypsum back in there. That's calcium sulfate. Sulfate has a tendency to bring out hop bitterness, and you don't really want that in here. And if you put in too much, it's going to get kind of a harsh bitterness, not what you want to have in this beer. So if you're going to add some calcium, you want the calcium to be 50 to 100 parts per million. And if you need to add some in there, use calcium chloride. Calcium chloride is going to get your calcium in there. The chloride's going to round out the beer, make it, you know, some more sweet on the palate, rather than accentuate the hops. You don't really need to add calcium carbonate or the chalk in there. Mm-hmm. You probably have enough in the water already, but you're going to need some. So if you're going to build water from zero, you're going to need to add some calcium carbonate in there. Generally, probably tap water would be fine, but if you're going to mess with it and you actually know what your water's got, don't start throwing stuff in there if you don't know. Or just brew like you always do. If you filter it and brew with it. Water composition can get tricky, but if you know what you're doing, you can really tweak this whole recipe to get what you want out of it.
Just ruin your bittering and all your hops and your flavor in there.
It can shove it one way or the other, so you're not gonna have what you aim for.
Right.
So I kind of try to explain to people simply what water chemistry is gonna do for you is one's the mash pH. And that mostly has to do with the calcium and the carbon that's in there. And the other thing, all the other stuff is more for seasoning. You want to bring out the hops more. You want to bring out the malt more. And that's what the other things, that's why you don't just add one kind of calcium to it.
And that's why you wouldn't add it to the stout beer either.
Right.
Right.
So, and if you add too much in there, you're going to end up with kind of Burtonized things, and it's going to taste real minerally.
Yeah.
And it will come through in this beer, especially with these yeasts. You're going to get a minerally flavor coming through. So, like I said, if you don't know what's in there already, don't be adding stuff. Just brew like you always do. You'll come out with a pretty good beer. If you make good pale ales with your water, you'll make a good Marzen with this one.
Right. What about mash? Mash temperatures and stuff?
That's what we're going to get to.
Cool.
All right, the next thing is the processes. So let's go with the prep ahead of time. You need a big yeast starter for this. It's usually a high gravity, above, 1056. It's a lager yeast. So you might want to start it a week before, maybe 3-4 days. Doing it the night before is probably not going to be good enough, building up one yeast vial the night before.
This style sucks. You can't put any hops in it. You can't do your yeast starter the night before. I'm out.
See ya.
And you got to keep it cold. And you got to keep it around for 6 weeks.
You got to keep it around for 6 weeks. Who invented this stupid beer?
And you're dating a German.
That's the way it is, baby. All right, so a Big E starter will help to get the terminal gravity down. If you have to a lesser starter, you're going to stress your yeast out, and they're probably going to poop out probably about 10:25, and it'll be an okay beer, a little sweeter than you'd like.
Yeah, it's pretty
sweet. You got to do everything you can. The more you get in there, the better. I don't think home brewer wise you're going to overpitch this one.
No.
It will dry it out. You'll get it down in the 10:16 range, which is probably just fine.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to plan ahead for that kind of thing. So I would start it a week before, feed it once, or maybe twice. A lot of oxygen when you do pitch, and you'll get a nice, happy, healthy yeast.
And you're pitching cold too, right, Doc?
I'm pitching cold, baby.
Yeah. See, if I was to do it the night before with one vial, I would do it on a starter and not even worry about it. Get it going the night before and pitch it warm at 68 and cool to 52 within like 12 hours.
I'm just trying.
It's turned out fine.
I would probably grow them up at... I wouldn't grow them probably. I'd probably grow them at 60, 65. I wouldn't grow them up.
Room temp. Yeah.
I'm trying to get it bigger rather than just wake them up. Okay. Do the night before, you're going to wake up the happy guys in there, but you're not going to get a whole big... increase in cell count. If you can start it ahead of time,
but you're getting them active though. You're getting them happy.
Yeah, right.
They're comfortable,
right.
And they're absorbing sugar. And, yeah.
Which is the assumption that there's enough cells in that vial already. Then.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah.
But you're just waking it up like smack pack. Yeah. So it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would, if you're gonna grow it. You're gonna need some time to do that.
Mm.
Start it on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Feed it again with some fresh wort on. By Wednesday.
So you got to pour off the wort?
Some people do, some people don't. If you've got a big enough jug to put it in, you just add it to there.
Okay.
I wouldn't even decant off of that. I would just throw more wort on top of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then possibly even once more the night before. Mm-hmm. Get it at high Kreuzen, so when you pitch, there you go. One thing you got to remember, though, if you're going to pitch cold, it's going to take some time to get that down.
Oh, yeah.
You might not, as soon as your brew session's over with, and you start the cooling, it could take a good 12 hours before you get it down to where you want to pitch. So plan ahead with your starter to have it at high Kreuzen when you're going to be pitching.
Would you drop your trub after that before you pitched?
I would.
Okay. Just have a cleaner.
Have a cleaner. Mm-hmm. So let's go into mashing. Mashing, you want to mash at a high temp. 152, 154, you want to promote your dextrins to add the mouthfeel to it. Again, you got to be careful with that, with the yeasts. If you do a lot of that, get that mouthfeel and a lot of dextrins, you don't want to finish high. You want to finish low in the 10:14, 10:16 range, and have the dextrins in there. So you got a mouthfeel, but it's still a drier beer. And rather than have a lot of dextrins, poop it out at 10:25, then you got a thick.
Yeah, it's way too sweet.
Yeah, it's sweet and thick, and that's not what you want either.
Plus, you have a hangover, too.
Yeah.
How are you feeling, Doc?
Oh, I'm good.
Good, good.
So, let's see. Boil, 90 minutes, 120 minutes, depending on what you want to do. You can boil 60 if you want. I like to try to get some kettle caramelization.
Hmm. Well, that'll add color.
That'll add color. It'll add some caramelization. If you're going to do that, you got to compensate for the water volume loss. If you're going to boil for 2 hours, you're going to lose a couple of gallons.
Right.
So make sure you add enough water in there to boil it back off. And for your pre-boil volumes, you can punch that into ProMash too.
Well, what do you recommend? Would you recommend doing a protein rest by chance to get more of the base malt flavors out of it and to get more efficiency than... I mean, traditionally, they do protein rest.
So traditionally, they're going to do decoction.
Okay.
And they're going to protein rest starting at 122, right. And probably another decoction to 145, and then probably at 157.
Okay.
If you feel like doing a decoction mash, or let alone a triple decoction mash, go for it. It's a lot of work. This beer will come out really nice with just a single infusion.
Sure.
And probably if this is your first attempt at this style, I would do the single infusion.
Right.
And then maybe move up to single decoction, something like that.
Yeah, I had a question about whether or not you would step mash in yours earlier on in the show.
I would because it's easy for me to step mash.
Mm-hmm.
I have a recirculation system, so it's easy for me. I would probably do a protein rest, and then I would probably do 144 and then probably 157.
But you could,
if you're using a picnic cooler, it's kind of hard to be throwing water in there and do the step. It's a pain in the butt.
So just a single infusion is.
Yeah, if you don't have a way to recirc and or raise the mash temperature, you could heat the mash kettle too. That's another way to do it.
Okay.
That'll caramelize it some.
Okay.
The great thing about a protein rest too is it'll increase your efficiency, 10 to 20% depending on your mash, whatever you're using. Also, I think it also contributes to more of a malt round flavor in a beer too. Okay.
It'll also help with the lautering. So when you're trying to rinse the grains, it helps loosen everything up so it's not so thick. And that's why your mash efficiency is going to go up.
Right.
Because you can rinse the grains a lot better when you don't have the glue of the proteins, big proteins in there.
Okay.
Sweet.
Yeah. So.
More importantly, someone wants to know if you have your jammies on today, Doc.
No. I've been up a long time. I got up about 5:30 this morning.
So. Why?
I needed to do prep for this show, and my eyes popped open. I guess I'm up.
Right.
So.
That's hardcore, Doc. Right on.
And you're brewing today, too, huh? Didn't you say that yesterday?
No, I'm not. No.
You're not going to do it?
No, I got actually, I'm rehabbing the bathroom. My wife wanted to redo the bathroom, so that's I'm going back and doing that. And then we got a Doe's meeting tonight.
And we're talking about this style.
So we got a big club meeting tonight that I still got to get ready for.
Gotcha. All right.
Good stuff.
I got a busy day today.
Yeah. You better wrap it up then.
Okay, let's wrap it up. Okay, hopping. I went through that again. Generally, two additions. One for bittering at a half ounce for 5 gallons, and then another flavor aroma at about 3/4. Fermenting, I like to keep it low, 48 range, something like that. It's going to take a lot longer probably to ferment all the way out that low rather than at 55, but that's okay. You get some time, leave it. One of the reasons why you want to get it off the tube to start, you don't really want it to be sitting for 3 weeks on that kind of stuff. So if you can, separate it out. Do the Justin where you put in one carboy, let it settle, and suction it off and put it in the other carboy. Then go ahead and pitch. Diacetyl rest, you can do it if you want. Basically, a diacetyl rest is the yeast is done fermenting most of the sugars in there. They'll start to reuptake the diacetyl back into the cell and make it into other things, but you got to give them a chance to do that. You can do that with time. Mm-hmm. It'll do it anyway.
Right.
Or it'll do it a little more efficient if you raise the temperature up. I would raise the temperature up at about 1025, and you can bring it up to around the 60-degree range. Leave it there for a couple of days, then slowly bring it back down. You can raise it as fast as you want, pretty much. They like that, but they don't like to get cold.
Right.
So you can kind of trick them into it. A few degrees a day or in a couple hours, you can bring it down slowly. Mm-hmm. Bring it back down to 1048 range and leave it there for a couple of days. Let it settle out. Once you're done, it'll clean up everything, even at the lower temperatures. Just give it some time.
How long would you let it go without doing a diacetyl rest? Normal primary and secondary ferment.
3 to 4 weeks.
To 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Primary?
Just three weeks probably in the primary.
Okay.
And see what it's like at that point. Maybe another week in there. Like Jamil says, he just kind of sets it and forgets it and comes back later. It's a lot easier not to have to deal with the diacetyl rest.
Sure.
If you don't stress the yeast, it'll probably not come out anyway. So that'll work. Let's talk a little bit about lagering. Lagering is basically yeast cleaning stuff up. The sulfur that's produced by a lager yeast is going to off-gas. It also rounds out the flavor and mellows things out. Mm-hmm. So you can lager high at 40, 42 degrees fast. It'll clean up a lot faster at a higher temperature.
Mm-hmm.
But it won't be as smooth and nice tasting as if you lager at 32, 33,
wow,
just above freezing. But it'll take longer that way. But everybody is in the same boat that says it's a lot cleaner, a lot mellower, a lot smoother taste profile when you slow lager. And it's going to take a lot longer at a low temperature to do that. So if it's going to be lower, you're going to get a better flavor out of it. And it's going to take longer. But you can do it faster.
Yeah.
And it's not just sitting there. The yeast are actually active at that low range. It's a lot slower.
Even at 33, they're still...
Yeah.
Wow.
Not doing a lot, but they're slowly...
Hanging out.
Yeah, hanging out, taking up things, and getting rid of stuff. All right.
We got... Are you done?
Yeah, I'm pretty much done.
Because I got some Q&A for you.
Excellent.
Got 5 minutes to do these.
Okay.
Okay. Back to recirc and whatnot. I want to know, you know, how clear are you going for when you're doing that recirculation? Are you waiting until it's perfectly clear that you can see that? Because some of the guys are saying that they do it until it's usually kind of cloudy still.
If they're going to be doing it manually, usually the manual way to do it is you take a bucket of some sort or a pot in the kitchen and run it off your mash, pour it back over the top. Usually three or four times, it'll set the mash bed and you'll see it noticeably clearer. And that's what you're looking for. If you pull it straight out the first time, it's going to have chunks in it and it's going to be milky, kind of. After recirculating the pot three or four times, you're going to notice a lot clearer. And then you're good to run it off at that point.
Okay.
Yeah, 15 minutes is about enough doing that manually. It'll totally run clear after 15 minutes. So
basically, just do it a few times if you do it manually. I have a pump, so I just kind of run it all the time.
Okay.
But you want to get the mash bed set. And whatever it takes, the mash bed's going to be different than it depending on the shape of the mash tun.
Okay. But it doesn't have to be crystal clear.
No,
okay.
But you'll know you should do that with any beer.
Yeah.
And at least get the mash bed set. When I used to do it manually with, you know, buckets and, you know, sawhorses and everything, I would probably run off half a gallon 5 or 6 times.
Okay.
Or a gallon possibly, and pour it slowly back in and try not to mess up the grain bed.
Right.
And
when I do that, by the way, manually, I use a pot. To drain off the bottom, and then I pour it into a strainer. Like I just hold a strainer over my bucket on the top so that it doesn't, because you're talking about disturbing the grain bed, because if I were to just pour it out of the pot, it really kind of stirs up the whole thing. And I found by holding a strainer like right over the top of the water line, I'm able to spread out that impact and it goes a little softer.
That I wouldn't do.
A manual way. You wouldn't strain it out?
No, because then you're hot side aeration.
But it's just, oh, okay, I got you.
Because it's hot enough to pick up oxygen,
yeah,
and when you put it through a strainer, a lot more surface area is going to happen. So when I'm recircing, I have my sparge ring, which actually beer coming through that. That's down under the water.
Oh, so you okay?
Yeah,
so
you could just set it on top of your grain bed.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Do it that way.
Okay,
I just get as close. When
you
I'm,
don't want
when
to splash.
Yeah, I don't want to splash, so I just get as close as I can and pour it down.
Okay.
Back over the top of that one.
That makes sense.
You also don't want to have a dry spot in your mash, too, so you want to make sure you have, 2 to 3 inches of hot water.
Right, yeah. The problem with letting it get down too far is it'll compact it, and maybe not all over, but in certain spots, if it gets compacted, you'll get channeling. So it won't rinse all the grains. It'll just channel down through a few spots, and your efficiency is going to go down. So by letting it keep a couple of inches of water above, then it doesn't compact all the grain. Grain's kind of get a little bit floating.
Yeah.
And it keeps it from packing down.
Okay. All right. And then I guess last question of the day would be, do you have any, either one of you have any experience using Saflager and what temperatures to ferment that at?
Dry yeast, no.
It's a dry, I've never used dry
never
yeast.
Never used it.
I've had good feedback from customers and they've liked
and
it.
And
so
that's one of the ones that I've got heard good feedback
okay.
on that one.
Yeah, all those new dry yeast strains out there right now are pretty good. Saffield, US 56, the T58, the Saflager, they're all very clean, so
okay,
definitely try them.
That would have been a good question for Chris Graham last night.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So we can always get back to that.
All right, so next time on the Jamil Show, Jamil's back, huh?
It'll actually be Jamil.
Yeah, it's weird. And American Pale Ale is the topic for you guys next time, I think, John.
Okay.
So that's 2 weeks from today. Jamil will be back with tons of jealous making stories of Europe and Belgian beers and all of that.
Hopefully he'll bring us some.
Yeah, no,
he will. Come on, you got to have faith in that, right?
Yeah.
Well, we're not letting him in the studio if he doesn't.
He has to close the door.
Yeah.
Turn around, buddy. That's fun.
All right, so that's next time on the Jamil Show. If you hang around here, I'm going to replay last night's show. It'll be coming up right after this. So stick around. It was a good show. If you missed it and you don't want to download it, you can just keep hanging out and listening. We had Ralph Olson from Hop Union on the show, and he was a cool guy.
He was a good guest.
And Doc slammed 4 beers in like 15 minutes.
Well, because you paid me for it.
Got paid. His liver made us $150 last night, John.
Hey, all for the
really?
Cause.
Yeah.
Yeah, Oz got it going in there, and it was up to 4 beers and $150.
That's awesome. What beer did you chug?
Two Gordon Beers Hefeweizens. Oktoberfest and something else. Oh, Nuki Brown.
Awesome. That's great.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Next time on The Jameel Show, 2 weeks from today.
The Jameel Show has been a production of the Brewing Network. Please send questions for Jameel to jameel@thebrewingnetwork.com. The Jameel Show airs live every other Monday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Brewing Network.